This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and for students with their sights on attending college next fall, December 1st is a big date for getting applications in. And as students throughout the Commonwealth apply to their dream schools, the country is in the middle of wrestling with the question of what means fair admissions. The Supreme Court currently considering a challenge to affirmative action in a Harvard case may overturn the policy upheld by previous courts. And while that's unfolding, another admissions practice called legacy admissions, which is giving prospective students favor if family members attended the school, is increasingly coming under fire. And we want to look at that today. So we're joined by James Murphy, a higher education policy analyst at Education Reform Now, which is a nonpartisan nonprofit think tank and advocacy organization that promotes increased resources and innovative reforms in public education, and Ellie Mistal, the justice correspondent for The Nation and a Harvard graduate. James, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ellie, welcome to you too.
Thanks for having me.
And since the Harvard case is going to come up, in full disclosure, I am also a graduate of a graduate program at Harvard University and served as an elected officer of the Alumni Association for a short period of time. All right. So, James, I will start with you. How did we even wind up with a practice where colleges gave favor to family members who had previously attended? Does this go way back, and how did it start?
Yeah, I always think of legacy preferences as a shameful practice with a shameful origin. It goes back to the 20s and 30s when Ivy League colleges were trying to deal with what they called the Jewish problem. Jewish enrollment was growing at these institutions. They were concerned, so they started instituting practices to curb Jewish enrollment. Legacy preferences was a way to do this, right? To give favor to the children of alumni.
So it wasn't from the beginning a leg up. It was from the beginning a closed door, if you will.
Yes. I mean, the thing about it, when they made these policies official, it was essentially turning something that had always been the practice. I mean, Harvard is hundreds of years old. Ivy League colleges are hundreds of years old. They've traditionally enrolled from a very small pool of people. So at the beginning of the 20th century, as they started reaching out and used testing to try and broaden the pool of candidates who excelled at testing, the children of Jewish immigrants. So they were coming in larger numbers, and some of the old WASP contingent looked around campus and said, oh, we don't like this. We need to change our admissions policies.
So Ellie Mistal, per the New York Times this July, while the exact number of schools that use the preferences isn't clear, a survey by Inside Higher Education in 2018 found that 42% of the private schools, which includes most of the nation's elite institutions, and 6% of public schools used the strategy. How has that affected, I mean, it's almost an obvious question, but how has that affected student diversity and access to higher education over the years?
Right. Right. Well, you know, let's put it like this. I was the first person in my family to go to Harvard University because the previous generation of my family couldn't. Right. Like, let's never forget that, you know, as James was saying, legacy admissions go back hundreds of years, in part because hundreds of years ago, there was a very small subset of people that were even allowed to try to go to colleges at all, and certainly to elite colleges. Right. So like, if I, as an African-American male, wanted to get a legacy boost to go to Harvard, I would have had to bring Skip Gates along to trace my lineage back to W.E.B. Du Bois. Right? Du Bois. Like that's what we're dealing with, right? So the point of legacy admissions has always been to keep the community at these elite institutions, as James was saying, a closed circuit, and it disadvantages people who were either newly unoppressed, if you will. It certainly disadvantages people who come from whose parents came from different countries, new immigrants and new Americans and such. So that's the kind of background for it. But let's remember, it's not just legacies that do this ossification of our elite institutions. We've got legacies, we've got dean's list admissions, we've got sports scholarships, we've got all sorts of things that
all
tend
kinds
to
of
privilege.
Paths.
Tend to privilege some over others.
So James, you wanted to add on to what Ellie just said.
Yeah, I just wanted to add. So we at Education Reform Now just recently issued a brief on legacy preferences. And I looked at the past 5 years of data on legacy, and I'll give you a number. It's just shy of 800 colleges provide a legacy preference. What's really embarrassing is that in Massachusetts, 3/4 of colleges provide legacy preferences. That's the second highest rate in the entire nation. And who does legacy? The older the college is, the more likely it is to offer a legacy preference, and private colleges. And then finally, most importantly, it's the super highly selective. There's only 64 colleges in the country that admit less than 25% of students. 80% of them, though, provide a legacy preference.
All right, so that's helpful data, and I know that a Wall Street Journal analysis of Harvard admissions from 2010 to 2015 found that legacy applicants were 5 times more likely to be admitted than non-legacy students. So, Ellie, I'm going to play you a little sound here from a conversation with Harvard President Larry Bacow, who spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty on Radio Boston back in July 2018 when he was coming in on this subject. Here he is.
I don't deny that we, like many other institutions, when it's a toss-up, tend to look harder at somebody whose family has had a long connection to the institution.
Why is that?
It's done because institutions like Harvard, they did not build themselves. They've relied upon people who've been willing to work hard to make these institutions the kinds of places that they are. And it's not just that somebody attended Harvard or a parent attended Harvard. We actually look to see who's worked to try and engage the community more broadly on behalf of the institution, who's been actively involved. And there, we do recognize people who've devoted their time and effort to help sustain the institution.
So that narrowing almost, Ellie Mistal, the idea to it's not just anybody who's, you know, parents, for example, went to Harvard University, whereas I understand it, the preference is for undergraduate legacy. But, you know, showing that you need to, you got to step up for the school, too. And I'm going to play, bear with me, because I'm going to play one more piece of sound for you, and then I'm going to let you let it rip for a second on this. Okay. Amherst College Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid, Matt McGann, talked about ending it. They ended it at Amherst. And here's what he talked about sort of a false narrative that he has seen in preserving legacy admissions. So this is cut A for the control room.
Very commonly, an argument is made that you need legacy preference to fund the financial aid of lower income students. And by pairing these two things together, we're saying that these two things do not need to be paired together. The idea of a legacy preference and fundraising for the benefit of low-income students.
So he's saying that's a false equivalency. So take all of that. Is there an argument to be made that these kinds of practices could create better outcomes for a broader number of students by favoring a smaller number of students?
Yeah, no, right? And I think Bacow kind of indirectly put it perfectly, right? It's not just that you have had to go to the university, you have to step up for the university. And what does that mean? Step up financially. When I was at Harvard, one of my on-campus term time jobs was to dial for dollars, right? Call former graduates and ask them to donate to the university. And one of the lines that you would find worked with people was when they had kids that were of college age, right? And suddenly, when your kid turns 13, 14, 15, you start think it's a good idea to donate to Harvard University, an institution with an endowment second only to the Catholic Church, right? Just to maybe your, $85 will help your kid get That is the thinking, and that is poisonous thinking. That is terrible thinking. You don't want your college, I don't think, to be governed by people in a pay-to-play situation, right? To say nothing of the fact that they're, if you're really just thinking about the financials of it all, there are tons of people who aren't legacies who also can afford the tuition, if that's actually what your primary concern is. But that's not the primary concern in any real way for the elite universities, for the Harvards and the Yales and the Dartmouths and the Princetons, right? Their concern is to preserve a certain kind of culture. And I think the other point that's worth making here is, we always talk about, in higher education circles, is it that a school like Yale, does Yale make the student, or does the student make Yale? right? Is it that? Is it just that Harvard is very good at identifying students who will be successful, or does Harvard itself help make that student successful? I think the jury is still out on that. But what you see with legacies is potentially another kind of opportunity or vector for Harvard to try to choose people whose parents themselves have been successful, in hope that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
So turning now to James Murphy to build off of that, Ellie. James, so Ellie's laid out a couple of things there that make me now think about the affirmative action case that is before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we had Tufts University professor Natasha Waraku on, who just wrote a book about affirmative action. She was on with us last month. What made me think of that was Ellie talking about, you know, preserving a certain kind of culture at a university and bringing forward students that they think can succeed. Her argument was that more diverse participation in a student body creates a certain kind of culture that is the one where everybody can succeed. What has been interesting is I didn't realize until preparing for this how much the comparison to legacy admissions came up in the Supreme Court arguments around affirmative action and whether or not it's fair to consider race, and that there was this argument saying, well, if you didn't have exclusion from legacy admissions, maybe you wouldn't need to consider race so much. So talk about that. There's an interesting linking now happening between these two concepts.
There is. I think the first thing to say is that I didn't think there was enough discussion of legacy during the Supreme Court hearing. So I attended the initial trial, the initial Harvard trial, and sat in court every single day for it. And legacy came up a lot, right? So Students for Fair Admissions made legacy an important part
of
their
case. They're
the
plaintiffs fighting the affirmative action policies of University of North Carolina and Harvard University.
Exactly, right? So they brought up legacy a lot in order to essentially embarrass Harvard, right? We're talking a lot about Harvard here, not just because it's Harvard, but because we have almost no data on legacy, right? There's barely any information out there because colleges hide this information away, and it's because of this case that we found out so much about Harvard.
Because it's one of the two, right, defendants.
Exactly. And what's true at Harvard is going to be true at a lot of other elite private schools. So they brought it up initially to embarrass Harvard. What ended up happening, though, in their Supreme Court filing, it barely comes up at all, right? So in much the same way that Students for Fair Admissions used Asian American students as kind of a cover for their argument to get rid of affirmative action, they used legacy as a cover for, you know, sort of the honorable nature of their case. It did come up several times during the case, and I think one of the reasons that the Supreme Court decision, which will likely be against Harvard and against UNC, is going to end legacy preferences is because these colleges, which I actually do believe care about diversity, are going to be looking for any and every practice that will help increase diversity. And because legacy is predominantly favoring white and wealthy applicants, right? If you cut that, then you open up more spots.
So I do want to note, by the way, we did reach out to Harvard in preparing this segment, and we got no response from them. So, Ellie, I'm going to play a little bit of sound from Viet Nguyen of an education advocacy group called Ed Mobilizer. Current Harvard grad student, went to Brown undergrad, on how removing legacy might affect his own kids. Here he is.
I'm Vietnamese American. My children will be legacies to Harvard. I do want more Vietnamese students to go to Harvard, but not my children, right? Like, I want the low-income students, the students whose parents did not go to college, who grew up, you know, in low-income neighborhoods, to have access to the education that I did. Like, my children will be fine.
And when they conducted a survey of Harvard University current students, they found that roughly 60% were in favor of limiting or eliminating legacies. So, Ellie Misdahl, are we at a tipping point? Or are the benefits to those who have power by being enfranchised by higher education still accruing too strongly to reverse this?
Yeah, I'm not as hopeful as James. I don't know that the Supreme Court ending affirmative action, which, I mean, is going to happen, that is going to be the decision in June. I don't know that the Supreme Court ending that is actually going to have the positive knock-on effect of universities also moving away from legacy admissions. I might hope for that to happen. I don't know that that's going to be their play. I do think that universities will look for diversity, and I think that what you're going to see is legacy minority students getting a real opportunity to go to some of these places, because it's one of the easiest kind of point and click ways that universities can maintain their diversity, and they will start making that argument. Even though it helps a relatively small percentage of minority students, I do believe we'll see universities making that argument that legacies for minority students are now one of the best vectors to get diversity at their school. But I do want to say this as well, like while we're talking about legacies as if they're only bad. I believe what should be happening at a college admissions level, and what does in fact happen at many colleges, is to look at a holistic kind of view of the student, right? So I do think that if you are a legacy at admit and the university wants to consider that, I don't think it's kind of prima facie bad. The question is just how much do they care about that, right? Are they going to put in a less qualified student who is a legacy versus and how do you define qualifications, right? There's a lot of things going into this. I always like to bring up for this the military school example. You know, when we look at our military academies, West Point, Annapolis, right? We know that they practice legacy admissions as well. You know, if you're telling me that you're a kid and your father fought in the war and your grandfather fought in the war and your great, great, great grandfather shot some British people, I don't know, like, and you have this tradition in your family of service, I don't know if it's bad prima facie if West Point considers that, right? Now, West Point is in a very different situation than Harvard or Yale, but you see what I'm saying? Like, there multiple things can be true at the same time. Legacy admissions generally are a bad ossifying force that prevents colleges from being a little bit more diverse. By the same token, the best admissions practice is a student holistic case-by-case practice that can take into account whatever people want to take into account.
So, James Murphy, last word to you, just quickly, couple sentences.
I remain hopeful. The thing to know about legacy is people hate it. 3 out of 4 Americans hate it. 7 out of 8 admissions directors are opposed to legacy. My hope is that this moment is going to give college presidents and boards the cover they need to turn to alumni and say, like, hey, if we can't give preferences to students who deserve them, surely we can't give it to the most advantaged applicants in the pool.
All right. James Murphy is higher education policy analyst at Education Reform Now. And Ellie Mistal is the justice correspondent for The Nation and a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law School. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Boston is known for a lot of things, but life at night is not particularly one of them. And today we continue our exploration of how the city wants to expand its nightlife economy in our series called After Dark, Boston at Night. And today we're going to focus on equity, how to build and maintain it as the city seeks to grow nightlife in Boston. Here with us to talk more about that, Luther Pinckney is the director of operations for The Pearl at South Bay, and Ruth Z. Louisjean is Boston City Councilor at Large. Councilor, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana. Happy to be here, and happy to be here with Luther from one of my favorite restaurants in Boston, The Pearl.
And Luther, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor.
So, Councilor, I got to ask you then, first up, what's your favorite item on the menu at The Pearl?
Ooh, the crab cakes. Got to go with the crab cakes.
Luther's nodding. I take it that's a regular favorite, Luther.
It is one of our best dishes, and I really stand behind it.
And Luther, how late do you stay open at night at the Pearl?
On the weekends, we try to stay open until 1 a.m.
And how is that going?
Pretty good. We definitely have a crowd. Some nights we have to ask them to leave nicely. People are definitely entertained and definitely looking for places to be.
And when you think about nightlife, Luther, in the city of Boston, what does nightlife mean to you as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, but also as a community member?
Diversity, having different options for people to be able to do different things. You know, we have a very, very large college population, and we cater to them fairly well, or in the past catered to them fairly well, but the adults, the 30-plus crowd, people looking for lounges, looking for late-night dinner and drinks in the evening, there's very few options.
Counselor, how about you? When you think about a vibrant nightlife for the city of Boston, what do you imagine?
Tiziana, I imagine, like Luther said, options and diversity. I imagine not being able to, not having to leave my own neighborhood. I live right on the border of Mattapan and Hyde Park. And I would like to be able to go out in my neighborhood and have dinner with my friends and able to, you know, grab a glass of wine, not in my neighborhood. Not everything needs to be concentrated downtown or in the seaport. Creating a fun and equitable Boston really means about investing in what fun looks like in our neighborhoods, whether that be in South Bay and Dorchester, where the Pearl is, a wonderful new addition, or in Hyde Park. We have a great new addition in Park 54, both Black-owned restaurants, both creating such vibrancy in our neighborhoods where folks can just go out in the evening and have a good time with their friends.
So I'm thinking, Luther, when you decided to open the Pearl at South Bay, why did you pick that location?
It was my only option.
Can you say some more about that?
It was, you know, there's not many opportunities for entrepreneurs in this industry that look like me. And, you know, when people ask me how I got the opportunity, I tell them it was like all things in Boston, two white men talking to each other, and one of them wanted to include me. So I had the opportunity to meet the people who own the mall. We passed down the deal on the person who originally brought me in. When I got with my team, we really searched and was trying to bring something to our local community and tried to bring something right into the Nubian Square, Dudley Square location. That didn't work out. So we were able to get into the property that we're at now, and they really gave us an opportunity. It's not an opportunity to make a lot of money, but it's an opportunity to get into the industry. And so now more doors are opening, but it really was an only option. We didn't, you know, we don't get opportunities to open downtown, definitely as we know, Seaport, anywhere else in town. Different local properties, if you own the property, you have an opportunity. But obviously, and we know with the diversity and the lack of diversity in ownership and properties and commercial properties, that's not an option.
So as we seek, Boston City Councilor Ruth Z. Louis-Jean, listening to Luther there, right, what I find myself thinking about is, so the city wants to make investment. They're going to hire a nighttime czar. This is a focus of economic development. There are real plans here. I think about, for example, the emergence of the cannabis industry 5-6 years ago, where there was a real intention from the beginning of an industry to say, let's do this in a way that promotes equity. Lots of public policy in place to do it. We've done a big series here at Radio Boston on the fact that that has not worked well, mostly because of access to property, financing, capital.
Guidance.
There you go. Business startup, et cetera. Thank you, Luther. So when we lay out, okay, so we want to do nighttime economy in Boston with equity, what are the key building blocks and can we get them in place this time, Councillor?
That's an excellent question, Tiziana. And I think that when you look at what you described and what you saw in the cannabis industry and even Luther's stories about just the gap in capital that it takes to start a business, to be able to either rent or purchase property, to even like the value around access or knowing the people that you got to talk to, even like listening to Luther's story, you're like, I'm glad it worked out for him, but it shouldn't have to be that way for everyone. And it shouldn't have to be that way, especially for Black and Brown folks who have been historically excluded from processes, who don't like the capital due to structural racism, to really compete. And so we need to be really thoughtful at the city level, think about how we are using our dollars to invest in communities, to really make up for that lack of capital and wealth that's really rooted in structural racism, which is why one of the proposals that I have along with my colleague, Councilor Orrell, is about having neighborhood restricted liquor licenses so that folks who want to start a restaurant and want to be able to sell alcohol, which is a big convener of people, can do so without having to worry about, do I have the $500,000 it takes to be able to buy a liquor license on the open market, you know? And so these liquor licenses would be restricted, would help to generate the revenue and the nighttime excitement and the evening excitement that we want in our neighborhoods, but is also doing that work that you talked about like thinking strategically about how we help neighborhoods and people who have often been left out of the process.
So, Councilor, I'll stay with you on this for just a second. And we've had you here on Radio Boston before about this home rule petition, which would grant up to 200 non-transferable all alcohol licenses over a 3-year period, and they'd be focused on Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury, and Hyde Park. You made a reference to the $500,000 to buy a license. So now I'm going to turn to Luther. That is in an environment where the state, based on a history, and this is true, of being concerned, it was a racist history of being concerned that Boston's Irish Catholics in the 20th century, if not curbed, at the state level would have too much alcohol flowing in the city of Boston. And the state maintains a lot of control there, which means that liquor licenses, kind of like taxicab medallions,
exactly,
are private property that are very precious to get. My understanding, Luther, is part of what was attractive about the business opportunity that was your only shot was that it came with one of those licenses.
Correct.
And could you have ever put together the capital to buy one had it not been for that?
I don't want to say never, but I it would have been very, very difficult. And it was the obstacles for many of us. You know, when the council is talking about these local licenses, for me, this is going to help grow the industry. As we know, the industry on another level can't recruit enough people to work in industry. So now you have an absence of workers, you have an absence of the need for the community, and we don't have any opportunity for any building of financial freedom. Equity does not mean equal or fair. Equity is deserved. We deserve a helping hand to make it more equal across the board.
Given the history of structural racism that has held back black and brown entrepreneurs in the city in the past.
Correct. And when you bring up the tax medallions, the difference in this industry is that more license would make their licenses more valuable because Boston would become a better entertainment city. We would be more attractive to larger conventions. We would be a more city, more vibrant city.
With more liquor licenses.
With more liquor licenses, with more people being entertained in our streets, in our communities. So unlike the taxi medallions, I believe long run, this will improve across the board. And those licenses that are still available to be moved anywhere will still hold their value. The licenses that will help generate that value will help economically and bring more equity into the community, hopefully.
We're talking with Luther Pinckney, who's the director of operations for the Pearl at South Bay, and Boston City Councilor at Large Ruth Z. Louis-Jean, about how to build equity into new initiatives to improve the nightlife economy in Boston. So, Councilor, I'll turn back to you. First, what's the status on the Home Rule petition? Where are you in your efforts to create these 200 non-transferable licenses?
So the Home Rule petition, we're still working on it here on the City Council. I think Luther mentioned, you know, we want to make sure that we hear from the diversity of folks who are running restaurants or interested in running restaurants about how to best implement this Home Rule petition. And so we're still working on it and talking to community. And so I'm excited for us to really roll something out that has really been vetted and has the support of community members. I have a Home Rule petition that is currently making its way through the State House to get four restricted liquor licenses to the Bowling Building in Roxbury and one in Dorchester at the Strand Theater to really help generate economic activity in those neighborhoods. So I'm excited about that work as well. And Luther said something which I think is really excellent in defining equity. I want to, you know, say that equity is actually more than just a helping hand. Equity, especially when we throw around the word so much lately, it's important for us to realize that it's a corrective action that we have to take as a city for the policy harms that we've created that have been rooted in these structural disinvestments and have been rooted in structural racism. So equity is about really creating a fair playing field by putting where your dollars are and saying that, okay, we have to do more investments here because of what we've done in the past. In order for us to really create and generate these neighborhoods that are not just surviving, but really thriving, we have to do this work and we have to do it equitably.
Correct. I agree totally. And I agree, again, all of that being done helps us all. Will make us a better city on many different levels, economically as well as just a better moral city.
So then the next question then is we think about what else to do. So we've talked about the issue of liquor licenses. I want to note that in our first segment on this in Boston After Dark, we hit hard on transportation. So it's part of the reason I haven't brought it back up here, although I will note for listeners, Luther, who is sitting across from me in Studio 2, just nodded vigorously, right? But we've done transportation. So now I want to ask, you know, what other kinds of policies affect pro or con? And I'm going to play a little bit of sound here. This is Arthur Jemison, chief of planning for the city of Boston, head of the Boston Planning and Development Agency. And he was here on Radio Boston talking about the relaunch of the city's initiative to revitalize downtown. And he talked about creating and maintaining incentives for developers to ensure that along with planned development, the city would also get affordable housing. So you get this mix. Here it is.
Are you going to build affordable housing on your site or right next door? Are you going to build more housing than maybe you would have otherwise? Are you going to have great first floor users that are going to drive use? Those are the kinds of incentives that we can build into zoning and also the plan downtown generally to make it very clear what we're hoping to have.
So what's the neighborhood you want your restaurant in Luther? What are all the building blocks and pieces of residential and other businesses and livable streets, et cetera? Because we got to be thinking about really big policy steps here if we want to bring this to fruition, right?
Absolutely. And again, so, you know, our place, the Pearl South Bay, is a very diverse place. It's in a mix because of South Bay, South Boston, Dorchester, South End, and Roxbury.
Kind of all intersect.
All intersect. It's a, one of the largest, you know, areas in town where everyone comes through. So we have the great benefit of having and being able to see so many different people. You know, our next location, very similar in Boston, Landing, another side of town, trying to connect Newton, West Watertown, and that part of town with Cambridge. We want to be a connecting part of town. We obviously want diversity. We want different diversity in many levels, in the residents, in the businesses. You know, in the South Bay Mall, they've been very intentional about trying to bring in local businesses. So the only other non-chain right now is a workout boot camp. Local people from the community. So it's great to be able to interact again. For the city to grow, you want everything to meet. You want diversity, you want mix of cultures, you want mix of finances, and a mix of people. When we talk, going back to the tea thing, it's very hard getting employees who, right now, the bulk of the hotel and restaurant employees work in or live in East Boston, getting them back and forth in town, making sure that our workforce is more diverse so that people have jobs in their community is essential. So again, mix and diversity is the key for me.
So, Councillor, I'll come back to you now. Luther talked about financial profile there, too, and you talked about the gap in capital earlier in this conversation. I'm thinking about things like the Foundation for Business Equity that Glenn Lloyd runs, and he's been, you know, Roxbury native, right, know, helped build City Fresh Foods, or Dr. Makeba McCreary, who's the president now of the new Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund. Do we have a financing ecosystem now in place that can help lift black and brown owned businesses, women owned businesses with the capital they might need to participate in this new nightlife economy?
That's another really wonderful question. And the work that Glenn is doing in Makeba, like, they're just really wonderful in creating, trying to really help us get to this goal of equity. I'll say that there's more that we can be doing here at the city level, right? From the government level to provide that support, that financial capital, whether it's, you know, it could be something, you know, as not as simple, but it could be thinking about what is a city-owned property and how can we use and leverage that to take away or to decrease one of the barriers that folks face when it comes to starting a business. I was at a community meeting the other day and heard a terrific idea from a community member about how the city can better support small businesses and entrepreneurs who want to get started but don't really have the capital but have a really great idea. And so I just want to uplift community because a lot of the really great ideas about the work that the city can be doing to really help, you know, bridge that capital gap, those ideas are already swirling around in community. And so, yes, I'm happy that we have the work that Glenn and Makeba are doing. And I think that on the city level, there's a lot more that we can do and lean into to really support people as they're trying to get started.
And I think, as the council is saying, it's going to take a group. It's going to take a village to do it all. So you can't put it just on the two of them. You know, there's other groups, the Lazoo organization, who is fighting for change. There are people all around the city who are trying to push for the same goal. A lot of us, you know, all of those people frequent the Pearl. They frequent the Pearl when we were suffering at the beginning and couldn't find the staff, and they dealt with the shortage of not having inventory or not having to wait a half hour for service. They went through fighting and helping us build. It's not going to be one person. The city council is not going to be able to do it herself. The city of Boston can't do it themselves. The state government, all of our elected officials have to get behind all of those people who are working in the nonprofit world to do it.
All right. Luther Pinckney is Director of Operations for the Pearl at South Bay, and Ruth Z. Louis-Jean is a Boston City Councilor at Large. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's got rum and molasses and spices like clove and ginger. It's like as big as a lily pad, and it got sailors through long journeys hundreds of years ago. It is a Joe Frogger cookie, and you might be saying, a what now? Although I can tell you we have them in the studio, and they smell amazing. But don't worry, if you're not from Marblehead, you probably have never heard of a Joe Frogger cookie, but it was the creation of Joseph and Lucretia Brown, Black entrepreneurs in the late 1700s and early 1800s who built a tavern and a community in their region. And while they're the focus of today's hidden history, the cookie made it all the way at one point to the cafe menu at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So here to tell us about the Browns, the cookie, their creation, this bit of our hidden history, is Lauren McCormick, who's the executive director of the Marblehead Museum, and Cabrilla Baumgartner, Dean's Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at Northeastern University. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
And Cabrilla, welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
So, Lauren, tell us about Joseph and Lucretia Brown.
Well, Joseph was born in North Kingstown, Rhode Island, actually. He was born enslaved to a man named Beriah Brown. And Beriah basically forced him to serve out his son's time in the Revolutionary War, but for doing so, allowed him his freedom.
So he was enslaved.
He was an enslaved man to Beriah Brown, yes, born in 1749. And after his freedom, which he earns from serving out his master's son's time in the war, he makes his way up to Marblehead, Massachusetts, on the North Shore of Massachusetts. We don't exactly know how, but when he's there, he meets Lucretia, who was born in Marblehead or Salem, we're not exactly sure where, but in 1773 she's born, and they marry, and as you mentioned, they purchase a building on what's called Gingerbread Hill in Marblehead, and they open up a tavern. And they enter into Marblehead myth at this time, myth and lore, because of the amazing cakes and gingerbread cookies, Joe Frogger's, that they serve, and they become very much a part of town's history and town lore.
So, Cabrilla, why is it important for us to understand the lives of Joseph and Lucretia? How do they help us understand who we are today?
Well, Lucretia and Joseph Brown ran this tavern in Marblehead, and it was apparently very popular among sailors and other clientele. And I was particularly interested in the Black Election Day celebrations that happened at the tavern in May. It was called Election Day, but really it was Election Week. And it was a festive occasion. There was lots of dancing and music. There's an image of Joseph Brown playing the fiddle as people around him dance. And so Black Election Day is an important historical event. It was celebrated annually from the 18th century to the early 19th century. And during Election Day, African Americans often voted for their own official representative. So that history is important, not just because of they're African Americans who are running their own tavern. That's important too, the entrepreneurship angle. But I also think it's important that they're part of the Black Election Day celebration. And that's part of North Shore's history and Boston's history and the history of Massachusetts.
So was Black Election Day and that type of celebration unique to our region?
It was not unique to this region. We have examples of Black Election Day celebrations occurring in Rhode Island and Connecticut and also parts of the South and into the Caribbean. So it actually has West African roots. So that's also why it's important. It's actually part of a global history.
So I do want to go to the entrepreneurship part that you did note, Cabrilla. And Lauren, I'll turn to you here. It was really striking because, one, we often don't tell the history of thriving Black entrepreneurs in the late 1700s and early 1800s, period, right, in the region. Correct. But two, Lucretia was kind of a killer businesswoman. And it turns out very powerful in making the tavern run, in selling goods. So let's talk a little bit more about this woman who really made a business mark in the Marblehead and Salem region.
Absolutely. And she is a fascinating character. And sometimes she gets lost behind Joseph Brown for various reasons. But I love to talk about her because, like you say, she is a female entrepreneur in a time when that in and of itself amongst white and Black individuals is relatively rare. And she's known for picking roses all spring and summer long so that during the winter she can distill them into rose water. And that was a very popular perfume and also something you would use in food back in the mid-19th century. So she's doing that. She is known far and wide for her wedding cakes and various types of cakes. It's told decades later, people remember her for that. And if you wanted a wedding cake in the Marblehead, Salem area, you went to Lucretia Brown. So she really did develop this amazing business and was such a part of the community that decades later, people who remembered her were writing about her in the newspapers and in the reminiscences. And just the fact that they gave so much to the community that years later, people remembered that. And centuries later, we still talk about them.
So her strength as a baker is how we now come full circle to the cookie, which is smelling fabulous. We have a bowl of them here in the middle of the table. Our intrepid producer, Sydney Bowles, made them last night with the recipe from the museum. So while I talk for a second, I'm going to ask the two of you to go ahead and grab one because we're all going to taste them. So Cabrilla and Lauren, please go ahead. Really basic ingredients like molasses and rum and ground ginger and clove. And as I understand it, Cabrilla, part of the reason that these were legendary, these Joe Frogger cookies, and the Frogger I think comes from, looked like the size of a lily pad, was that their ingredients made them kind of last. They lasted a really long time, so you could buy them in barrels and put them on ships. And Marblehead was a port town. So they actually physically had quite a long reach as well as historically.
That's right. That's right. The cookies preserved fairly well. So sailors were able to take them with them and keep them for a couple of months, and they would have them at sea.
And Lucretia Lauren was known for, I mean, it's called Gingerbread Hill, which is where the tavern is. And she was known for, in her wedding cakes, for example, gingerbready kinds of flavors, clovey, spicy kinds of flavors.
Absolutely.
All right, so the number one rule of eating on radio is that you don't all take a bite at once, but we're going to. And I want you to go ahead and react as you take. Mine is crunchy on the edges and nice and chewy on the middle, and I'm going to take a bite here. Everybody's going to taste them. So they're very strong. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of rum, a lot of molasses in there. I got to tell you, this is the kind of thing I imagine a sailor at sea would want to eat after a meal. You know, I'm not sure I'm looking for a Madeline right at that moment. I think this might be more what I like. Lauren, what's your reaction to the cookie?
They're fabulous, right? Like, a lot of people have said they're sort of gingerbread in a cookie form. So you have that little crunch that you don't always get with gingerbread. And like you said, they'll last. And that's what's great. And what's also interesting about them is that they're made with rum and molasses. And those things are products that were produced by enslaved people. And so here you have two people touched by enslavement themselves in various ways who are known for this cookie. Mm-hmm.
Cabrilla, pick it up from there.
Yeah, I think it's delicious.
I'm still eating, by the way. I think it's fantastic, actually. Keep going.
Yes, it's a fairly large cookie, chewy, and but still soft and flavored with these spices. It was thought that Lucretia invented the recipe, but she named the cookie after her husband, after Joe. So they have Joe Frogger's cookies. But it is part of New England history. It's part of African-American foodways that we have this recipe and that we can now make a cookie like this.
And this cookie recipe, as we understand it, made its way all the way to the National Museum of African-American History and Culture, where it is not on the menu in the cafe right now. But I understand you had it there. Is that correct?
That's right. I did. I was a bit surprised, actually, to see the cookie on the menu. And when I saw it there, I ordered it, and it was delicious.
So tell me, tell us, Cabrilla, being able to track the legacy of a family, an historic family, a family that surprises or defies expectations as we've set them today, through their food, through their commerce, tell me about the importance of that as we work all the time, really, right now, to retell ourselves a story of our history as an America and an American economy.
Right. So as a historian of the Black experience, I'm often trying to tell these stories from the past, from the 18th and 19th centuries. And African Americans did not often leave diaries or letters, which are more traditional narrative sources that historians rely on. And so we have to rely on these other kinds of sources to understand their lives. And that means a cookie recipe can tell us a little bit about African-American foodways in New England. I also was able to find Lucretia Brown's will. And I could see the property she owned and the bank accounts that she had. I found her obituary, where she's described as a respectable woman and a useful member of society. And these sources start to allow us to recreate her life and understand her as a person.
So we are talking about a piece of the North Shore's hidden history with Lucretia Brown and Joseph Brown, with Cabrilla Baumgartner from Northeastern University and Lauren McCormick of the Marblehead Museum. Now, the taverns, as I understand it, Lauren, they first purchased the tavern as a home, and they were able to obtain at least at some point a mortgage for that property. And then I'm assuming they lived, what, on the second floor of the property and ran the tavern on the first floor? Do we know?
We don't actually know exactly. We know that Joseph purchased a portion of the building in 1793 and then the remainder of the building in 1796.
Because originally two families purchased it essentially to both live there, and then Joseph purchased the other half from the other family.
Yes, which wasn't unusual in that time period. And so the building still exists, and we don't know exactly how he used it, but certainly some of the memories are of them being on the first floor and Lucretia serving from a bar or a counter and Joseph playing the fiddle, which he was supposedly very good at, during Negro Election Week or at any time.
Now, in one account that I read, it was said that he might have only actually known one song on the fiddle, but that he could play it, Yankee Doodle Dandy, I think, but that he could play it a whole bunch of different ways. You're both nodding knowingly, so who wants to answer that one? Cabrilla?
I mean, that's what the sources say. I like to think he probably knew more than one song.
Yeah, it just seems like if you could play Yankee Doodle Dandy 50 ways, you could probably think of something else with the same chord progression, at least, that you could also play. All right, so your favorite thing about the history of Lucretia and Joseph Brown, Lauren?
I think it has to go back to the impact they made in the community. And again, the fact that we remember them however many years later, this is, you know, like 100-something years later, we are still talking about them. In fact, we now have a school in Marblehead, an elementary school named for them. We have really highlighted them. There's a conservation property that is named after Joseph Brown. And it's just the memories we have of them and the impact they made on the town.
And Cabrilla, who's the next person you want us to begin to get curious about as you're looking at this history? Who's another piece of hidden history you want us to get curious about?
I would say Robert Morris. He was one of the first African-American lawyers in the United States. He was from Salem, and he practiced law in Boston. And Lucretia was part of his family.
How?
Lucretia was Robert's aunt.
No kidding. All right. So a family whose legacy just continued along the way. So interesting. And delicious, the Joe Frogger cookie. All right. Cabrilla Baumgartner. Baumgartner is the Dean's Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at Northeastern University. Lauren McCormick is Executive Director of the Marblehead Museum. It is the Joe Frogger cookie from Lucretia Brown and Joseph Brown. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Try the cookies and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.